This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Ha, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. And we're actually solo for this one today. It's just myself. Jen is taking this week off.
All right. Well, we are looking forward to some private time with Dr. Lyle, and then we'll be looking forward to some private time with Dr. Hawk coming up soon as well. So,
all right,
Dr. Hawk, we miss you this week, but we'll look forward to talking to you another time. So, Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening? You ready for some fun questions?
All is good. Let's see what we got.
All right. Here we go. Dr. Lyle, I want to start with a thank you for all that you do. Life has been making more sense ever since I started listening to the podcast. My question today has to do with arrogant and cocky people. I have a brother-in-law who is mildly successful, makes decent money, but he thinks he's the most intelligent and successful person. He constantly finds ways to brag about how well off he is and how he's just better than everyone. How does one deal with a person like this? I don't spend much time with him and I'm polite, and when we have family functions, it's hard for me to not get upset about his comments. I've heard other people suggest that it could be a problem with me and that I'm being insecure about my own successes and taking it out on someone who feels that they are winning at life. I don't know how I feel about that train of thought, given that my husband and I have a more successful marriage and make more money. What can I do to improve my feelings? If it is a manifestation of any issues I may have, what can I do to improve? I can't wait to hear your opinion. Thank you.
No, you don't have issues. This is just a disagreeable human that is also extroverted enough, loud mouth enough about it, that he is pushing his belief that he's superior in everybody's face, and this is of course going to make us uncomfortable. That sort of self-advertising not only indicates that they're difficult to deal with in terms of negotiations because they think they deserve more out of a deal, but it's also true that we feel them sort of pushing their PR in the village, and that maybe some people will believe it and they will somehow gain cachet by that kind of self-advertisement, and that this is increasing the competitive process in the village for who has the most cachet, and you feel like you should have more cachet. You're actually more successful, more stable, more reasonable in terms of your negotiating with other people. In other words, you're a nicer person. And now we see this sort of pushy, arrogant person pushing to the front of the line, and it's going to make us uncomfortable because he's signaling to other people that he's superior to you. And if he thinks so, then that is a potential fish trick where other people could be reading his mind and saying, well, there must be a reason he thinks that. And that starts mobilizing you to start to feel competitive with him and try to essentially reorganize people's thinking, including ours. So just by asking that question, you were sure to say, listen, my husband and I are more successful than he is. Our marriage is more successful. So he's actually not more successful. And yet this is what's coming across in these social situations, and it's uncomfortable. Yeah, it is uncomfortable. So no, this is not your problem. This is just the fact that you're a different personality, essentially competing for social esteem in some trough of humanity where we've got a loudmouth there that is self-promoting. so I would say, no, it's not your problem. However, it's obviously a location we don't want to be in very often, and we want to minimize our exposure to him to optimize your life. So I would look at anything where he's going to be with a cost-benefit analysis and try to figure out, you know, why on earth we're there in the first place and whether or not that's how we want to spend some hours of our life. When he's around, you know, go to a different room and talk to somebody else. This is, I look at people like this of any ilk. Yeah, they can even be quiet and introverted, but they got that same kind of arrogance. I have no interest in giving them 3 minutes of my time. And so I see them as radioactive. Dr. Hawk calls it personality cancer. she will stage it. Like, yeah, she'd call that guy stage 4 personality cancer. And our job is to just stay away. So yeah, nothing to be done on your standpoint. This is reasonable that you would feel threatened and irritated, and that it would activate competitive instincts and it would be unpleasant. And so that's how it is. And so he can go, you know, swim where he is still wanted with that attitude, and you better go find somewhere else to play. It's kind of like a different people, different basketball games. So you go to one park and it's okay to hand check people and to push them around and camp in the key, you know, and it's like you go to another park and people know how to play the game properly. And it's like, you know what, I'll just go play where people know how to play by the rules rather than sandlot jungle ball rules. And I've been in that situation many times where it just wasn't worth playing at a place because people see things differently about how things ought to be played. So that's how I would look at this and just stay away from all such individuals, including this guy.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful point too, because you know, I really love Dr. Hawk's, you know, the staging the cancer, because It makes me think of, you know, the environment is how much of this is village dependent, i.e. the audience that the person is gathering. Is this a vulnerability in human psychology where any old, you know, extrovert, disagreeable person can cajole them into, you know, looking at them differently? Or is this going to take a certain level of IQ or certain type of personality of the audience to essentially recognize that and also be annoyed with it?
Yeah. In other words, this is a swirling cauldron of free market dynamics with respect to esteem seeking. And so all kinds of sales jobs and techniques are going to work. I think we have one of the most extraordinary examples of this in American politics that you've ever seen in politics, which is that when I think of the contrast between Donald Trump and Jeb Bush, it would be very hard to have seen two people that would be, that their ways of doing politics could be so different. You know, Mitt Romney was far more argumentative and tougher than Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush is, you know, a very stable, low-key, really sort of an ordinary bureaucratic, you know, pretty decent sort of a guy. That's what he seemed like to me. And Donald Trump is the ultimate of self-promotion. We've never had a presidential level candidate in the United States that had that personality. Amazing. Just complete stark contrast. And I think that of the people who have a lot of agreement with Trump and like him, they get a big kick out of that personality. People that don't like him and disagree with him are just appalled at his style, in the same way that this lady is just very disturbed by her sort of bombastic brother-in-law. And so you can see the political left, for example, feels like Trump is very unfair and they're really upset and he's somehow not playing by the right rules and he's not, you know, there's no decorum, etc. In other words, he's just playing it differently. He's in the park league where it's okay to hand check, camp in the key, and push. And that's just how it is. And of course, the truth is that in politics, it isn't free for all. It's a total free for all. And so who the heck knows what the best strategy is? Probably any major political analyst that was looking at the candidate situation in 2016 Probably there is not one in the United States, a learned political analyst, that would have said that personality and personality style is going to win. That I don't think anybody would have thought that was possible. So Trump thought it was possible, and some of his backers or some of the people around him thought it was possible. His wife had seen that personality be so successful for so long. Apparently, she famously said to him, well, if you run, you know, she didn't want him to run, but she said, if you run, you'll win. It's like, because she had seen that personality and its success with so many things that she just thought, God, you'll probably win the damn thing. And I would not have personally thought so. I would have thought that personality would have rubbed so many people so wrong so often that there's no way impossible that could have been successful. So the truth is that life and politics is a swirling cauldron of free-for-all. And for my money and the time of my life, the whole thing is find people, Dr. Hawk has a way of saying this, think of yourself as essentially a fixed quantity. You can't transform your personality. You think of yourself as the kind of a plant you are, and what kind of life you have is where that potted plant, you know, is set. So go find the location in the house or the office or wherever it is, you know, essentially the environment, the social ecology potentials of your life. Go find the place and walk that potted plant over there and set it where it's got the right amount of light and the right amount of water and, you know, and the right environment around it where there aren't a bunch of people smoking, and just settle right in and enjoy your existence rather than trying to transform the environment around you or you know, change the people around you or their opinions of anything. Forget it. Just put yourself in the best possible circumstances in terms of your social ecology and let the rest of the world go wherever it's going.
That's wonderful. Thank you. And virtual thank you for Dr. Hawk for that insight as well.
Yes,
this leads directly into our next, right into our next question, which is about the epidemic, the supposed epidemic of anxiety today. So this is directed for Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, but since you're only here, Dr. Lyle, we'll just take your answer. Dear doctors, I would like to understand this epidemic of anxiety that is happening these days. What is happening? I have 5 children, 2 of which are stepchildren. They're all thriving, successful, socially contributing adults ranging from 20 to 37. 2 of them are doctors. 4 of our children and 1 daughter-in-law are all suffering from high levels of anxiety. 2 of them are even taking medication for it. I have taken medication for several years now, and I see it in... I have taught meditation for several years now, and I see it in the classrooms with children, even as young as kindergarten, saying that they can't turn their brains off and they are always thinking of the possible outcomes, often worst-case scenarios of every situation. They suffer with being able to fall asleep, have trouble letting go, and just plain old relaxing. Their anxieties are different among them. The girls seem to get anxious about general life situations, and the boys are more anxious about every ache and pain in their bodies being some sign of a horrible disease. I'm so confused as to what's going on in this world that so many people have anxiety, and how, as a parent, I can help them. I've tried to introduce various meditation techniques and believed it's helped a little bit, but who listens to their mom anyway? In any input into what might be the cause of this and how they can get rid of it without medication. I love your show so much. I'm going back to school at 57 to get a degree in psychology.
First of all, there's a lot of pieces to this that are, you know, probably worth reflecting on. And that is that this is, you know, theory-based perception. So once you are looking for something, you start to see it everywhere. So the truth of the matter is that there isn't an increase in anxiety today. The anxiety levels today are no different than they were 20, 30, 40, 50, and 1,000 years ago. It's all the same. So all you're really looking at is you're looking at high conscientiousness. So, and wedded to is anxiety is more evident when high conscientiousness is wedded to instability. just natural instability. So those two personality characteristics are what will drive what we are going to call anxiety. So it's no surprise she's got two kids that are MDs and apparently a bunch of little people in that family that are high conscientiousness. And so it's no surprise that we should find, we wouldn't be surprised to find generally higher levels of anxiety inside that gene pool. Strangely enough, also including perhaps some adopted kids, wouldn't be surprising that you could get some in there too. That doesn't mean that anything got learned, because it didn't get learned. These are innate characteristics to people. So I wouldn't be making generalizations about boys and girls. When people start saying things like that, usually they're talking about one case that they've seen, or two, maybe three, probably not. Okay, and once they start to formulate an opinion about a pattern, they don't look for disconfirming evidence. So there is no pattern that boys are more apt to have aches and pains and worry about those, and girls are more worried about something else. That isn't going to be the case. So so all you have here is a highly conscientious individual herself, or she wouldn't have been teaching meditation, who is now sensitized to the fact that a bunch of people around her are struggling with a lot of anxiety, to the point of, I guess, using medications, which is, of course, a mistake. And she's trying to figure out, what can you do about it? Answer, nothing. You're looking at personality characteristics. And so these personality characteristics will not change. The person's anxiety will go up and down according to the local ecological inputs that are impacting that nervous system. So there's a few things that are a good idea to do if you're an anxious adult: exercise and save money. Okay, those are two things that can knock down the anxious person's just general level of agitation. And it turns out a lot of them already do that. So after that,
I love how simple the advice is, Dr. Lau. It's like, it doesn't have to be so complicated.
No, it's exercise, save money, try to do a meditation class and see if that, if your nervous system bites on it. And if that won't fly, you know, you're out of luck. One of the things, a strange concept for some people to consider, not most people, but it certainly is true for a lot of highly anxious people, particularly if they're very bright and they have a lot of options with respect to their work. And that is, try to be underemployed, okay? Don't try to get the highest job or the highest paying job or the most responsible job that requires the most level of responsibility. In fact, try to be the best fish in the aquarium. So, and if you, in these situations, this can reduce your anxiety, because you know that you are more valuable. In other words, what you want to be is underpaid. If a highly anxious person is underpaid, their nervous system is still subject to running computations on their situation with respect to their environment. So if you imagine the following, what's happening with a highly anxious person, a highly conscientious slash anxious person, is that they are imagining the worst case scenario. But their imaginations of the worst case scenario are not an all or nothing thing. It's on a continuum. And it's based on the evidence that is coming into the system. So, you know, if they're a 90th percentile employee and there's a 10% layoff, they're anxious enough to believe that they may get the axe. Okay, so that's while there's a low conscientious person that's at the 12th percentile that isn't even sweating it. Okay, so this
totally
is, these
fair.
Are the unfair. Yeah, this is just how it is. Okay, now, but the thing is if you yourself are some 95th percentile, you know, very anxious, highly conscientious individual, then it's a good idea to be fancier than your job title or your income. In other words, knowing that the other people on the other side of the table know that they're getting quite a deal by having you be there. You may be essentially have a steady stream of cues from that environment, from your boss and the organization, that it's like, wow, we're sure lucky to have you. We're sure lucky to have you. That's the kind of feedback that you want to see, where you know, oh boy, am I secure. So that's one way to look at the problem. Most people don't need to ever consider such a thing. But some people, you know, depending upon who they are, if there's enough natural instability and enough high conscientiousness that they're living under a lot of internal tension about how it could all go wrong and they could lose their position and that it's all going to be a disaster, that's a good time to get underemployed. So if you could be the head of the ophthalmology surgery department, don't take it. Don't go for it. This is how you beat your genes. Just be a run-of-the-mill ophthalmologist in the department. Don't look to be the chief, even though everybody says, oh, but your work is so good and you're so well-organized and you work so hard and you put in more hours than everybody else. You know, you should be chief. Okay, when the head of the hospital comes and says, you should be chief, you're the most decorated, hardest working, best record, et cetera, et cetera. We want you to be chief. Don't do it. Okay? That's how you beat your genes right there. Don't bite for too much of the sandwich. Just back off. So that's another little aspect to think about when it comes to managing your life. There is, you know, one way to get super anxious is to get lucky, to get overpaid and essentially over-rewarded. That's a great way to, you know, stay up late in the middle of the night, night after night, thinking about how on earth you're going to keep that position. Another way to do it is to be underemployed, at which point, wow, what a position of power. Okay, like in 2 seconds, I could replace this job because I'm underemployed. So obviously, most people, the right move is to be right in the middle at an appropriate cost-benefit analysis. But if you happen to be, you know, on this neurotic side of the curve, give yourself a break. See what it feels like to be more in a position of power. That might help you.
And Dr. Lai, would you suspect a similar thing can be done as far as romantic relationships go? If someone just is a naturally anxious person with regards to romance?
Yes, I do. In other words, for people that are naturally anxious, probably, you know, not a bad idea to be headed for somewhere where you feel like where the other person is giving you a lot of signals that they feel like they're over-rewarded. Okay, that's good. See, so a lot of people that are very sensitive about this and worst case scenario mongers, etc., sometimes their best situation is to be in a situation where the other person is very into them, where it feels like maybe the other person is getting, quote, the better end of the deal. As long as you're into it, it's, if you are that personality, better to be under-rewarded than over-rewarded. And I've actually seen that be helpful for people with those personalities in my own practice and in my own life. It can settle down the anxiety and make an anxious person feel considerably more secure and happier.
Wonderful, wonderful. all right. Well, our next question is, well, you know what? I have a question about this that I'm kind of rolling around in my head. So let me kind of wind out and see if it makes any sense. My thinking was, if someone's extremely anxious, you know, to the extent that it might have to do with that they are not being as competitive as they could be, and they just need to do some hard work, you know, to what extent would you recommend that, hey, they got to get to the fundamentals and really get to work and really improve their position?
Oh, yeah, that's a little bit different. So that's a... Normally, you have achievement motivation that is driving people to do that anyway. So that's not normally highly anxious, conscientious people are not in the situation that you're talking about. However, there could be people that could be ego-trapped and are procrastinating and are also, you know, sufficiently anxious and they haven't have enough of an ego trap dynamic that's taking place, that is what they need to do. And so what they do need to do is they need to break a problem into fundamentals, start to do the steps and look for what happens to their self-esteem as a result of making diligent efforts. And that will reduce your anxiety, because the anxiety can spin in some individuals as they are essentially ego trapped and essentially frozen up. And as a result of that, that anxiety can just, you know, sit there for a period of time at a very high state where they're effectively paralyzed. So, of course, if that's the situation, then we want to, the solution to that situation is always the solution to the ego trap. Solution to the ego trap, whether the ego trap is being sprung from our knowledge of outside people's overestimation of our abilities, or whether or not that's just simply internal to the internal audience, simply has a overly high estimation of our abilities. In either case, the solution is the same, and that is to quietly break down the problem into its fundamentals and begin working the fundamentals, put the hours in that are involved in improvement, whatever that is. It might mean chopping carrots, or it might be, you know, going and getting some balsa wood from Home Depot so that we can learn, you know, we can work on our carving. Or it may be getting our kayak out and going and paddling. Whatever it is that we're feeling intimidated about, or getting in front of a, you know, getting our pen out and trying to write haiku, whatever it is, it's the effort that you put in that is diligent, that there's nothing like a couple hours of diligent effort for the internal audience to observe that we're actually trying as best we can. And once it sees that, it starts to not only recalibrate its expectations, but it starts to feed the esteem meter positive signals of esteem. Not glorious and not loud, but quietly saying, well done, good job. I see that you're working hard and you're doing the best you can. That's what the internal audience will say to you through the esteem meter. And that will dial down anxiety. Okay, so because the expectations are being appropriately modified, as the internal audience watches your progress or lack thereof, it gets a sense of where you are in the learning curve or the achievement curve with respect to whatever it is that you're working on. And everything settles down if a person's been frozen over into an ego trap dynamic. But that's a different problem than I think the one that we were originally talking about, which is just general anxiety. General anxiety does not always in any way trace its footsteps back to the ego trap. Most of the anxiety that anybody's dealing with the type of problems that our questioner is asking, this is absolutely sheer 100% personality. It's never changing. Okay, and so that anxiety is dynamic. It's dynamic in the sense that that it will change from minute to minute and hour to hour, depending upon the ecological challenges that the person's dealing with. But the general level of anxiety that the individual is going to have over this lifetime will be unbelievably stable. So if you're an anxious, neurotic nutcase, you're going to be an anxious, neurotic nutcase from your first birthday to your 99th. It's just how it is. Okay?
That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, so that's how that works.
I got my wires crossed a little bit as far as being really specific to one particular issue, because I mean, where that was stemming from is here at the Fasting Escape. Like people will come in and they're usually very anxious about their health, in particular weight and how they look. And then a few days in, a few weeks in, when they've lost a little bit of weight and they kind of already are feeling comfortable where they are, I can just watch their anxiety reduce. And, you know, maybe it's because it's a more relaxing environment or whatever it is, but that little chip calms down a little bit. They're still kind of anxious in general, but that part calms down. So.
Yeah, let's look at this. So let's see what's taking place there, because that's interesting. You know, I've seen that very many times watching this process, that the person comes in often very upset and really twisted up and desperate over a very common thing for people to come in with fasting, even though, as you know, we're not advertising and trying to sell the concept of water fasting to lose weight. That is the primary thing. However, it doesn't matter. As much as we try to keep people focused on general health, it doesn't matter. They're crawling through the door, you know, are very upset about their weight and they desperately want to lose weight. And obviously, as you know, we're not going to fast people unless it's appropriate. But if it is appropriate and weight loss is the number one, you know, thing that's actually on their mind and general health is second, certainly fasting them makes sense, and that we're going to then find out, they will discover that they're not a freak of nature, that they're not violating the laws of thermodynamics, and the fact that they've been trying to lose weight really hard for the last 3 months, 6 months, 9 years, or whatever the hell it is. Bottom line is, sure enough, when they start water fasting under supervision, they start losing weight. And they find out that they can tolerate it, as you know, Nathan. And it turns out that they might go 6 days or 16 days or whatever it is, and by God, there's a significant change in their body morphology. And when that happens, what's happening is that it's increasing their perceived self-efficacy. So their confidence starts to surge because they can see, okay, I'm not locked in by nature to some you know, social psychological hell where I can never lose this weight. They see that, oh my God, it is in fact possible. That is a very positive thing that happens as a result of water fasting. You could still see some anxiety about, well, gee, I wonder if I'm going to gain it back, or I'm not sure I can do this, all those kinds of things. But having a big victory and seeing that their body is in fact not a fat storage machine that will fail them just at the twitch of a Cheeto, that this actually helps them know that, okay, that my body is subject to natural law, just like I've been hearing from the people who are educating us around these issues. And so what you're watching is the anxiety is dropping because the perceived self-efficacy of being able to manage the problem is increasing. No question. So that you, particularly if you have a highly anxious personality walking in with the issue, then they can be bouncing off the walls until we see some success. They see success, and now the anxiety can drop quite a bit. But I would argue that if they're pretty bouncy when they come in, they're probably not naturally very calm to begin with. They're probably naturally pretty conscientious and got some instability in there, or we wouldn't be seeing any of that at the start.
It's interesting. Yeah. My engineering brain is always trying to calculate at what stage will their anxiety drop, and it seems to be about 10 to 20% of the body weight drop. So I don't know if there's anything significant there, but maybe it's
because that's
when someone can tell that they lost weight.
Yes, that's fascinating that you say that, because I have no doubt that it's probably the just noticeable significant difference, okay? There's a point at which they realize, no, I'm definitely different. And I'm definitely have now moved to a different level of attractiveness, and it this is definitely working. So, you know, 2 days and losing 4 or 5 pounds of water weight isn't going to be a great victory. But 10 days when they've lost 17 pounds, it's mm-hmm. like, wow, there is a big difference in my morphology. And so the confidence then appropriately has risen a great deal. And so a lot of the anxiety has dropped. So you can think of this as anxiety and confidence are very often essentially opponent processes. They're literally, think of someone who's very confident. You're thinking that, okay, their anxiety is very low, okay? Think of somebody who's very unconfident. You're thinking about their anxiety is very high. The amount of the anxiety is a matrix of not only the confidence level, but also what's at stake. But you can imagine that what's at stake with someone who flies 1,000 miles to come to your fasting facility and is telling us that they're worried about their overall health, but really they're also very worried about their weight. And they're worried that they may never be able to get a handle on this, and that they're so frustrated. And they may feel their relationships are being threatened, or that they're, you know, of various kinds, or that certainly they can tell that their self-confidence and their self-esteem is under quite substantial assault. So when they come there, they can be quite anxious, but that we can see that even at the beginning, they're not sure that they can do it, and they're not sure if it's going to work for them, because God knows, are they really sure that it's going to actually work? And when it does, and it works, you know, very well, then the relief is huge. The confidence goes to an appropriate level, and therefore the anxiety now drops because the confidence is greater and the issue on the table so significant that the emotional change that takes place as a result is very evident. And that's what you've observed.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you for explaining that. It's really nice to hear it in words.
Yeah,
like,
good.
It's like running a lab experiment and then having the professor say, yeah. Well, this is what's going on.
Yes. So. And it's very, it's nice to know it's very lawful, okay, because the machinery of the mind, the computations, and therefore the motivation and emotional processes are lawful. And so these are the laws that they work by. The more confident you are, the less anxiety you have. The more important the issue is, you can imagine that if the issue is life and death and your confidence is 98%, it's still, you've got some serious anxiety. Okay? That's like, you know what? I'm pretty sure we're fine, but it's still 2% that we're gonna buy the farm. So we would expect anxiety to be pretty high, even out of 98 out of 100, if our life's on the line. But if our confidence goes to 90% that we can get a weight problem under control, that is, you know, and it started at 20% and now it's at 90%, or it started at 20% and now it's 60%. The surge of relief behind that increased confidence can be huge in terms of reducing anxiety.
Now, I remember seeing this a lot at True North when I was working there, but I see it a lot more here because of one invention that was there now that wasn't there when I was at True North, which is FaceTime. So people will call the people in their life, their family members or friends, and the people will remark, "Oh my God, you look so much different." It's like somebody who hasn't watched the process. You know, everyone's sitting here, you know, doing fasting together, so they can't really see their own transformation, but their friends and family do.
Yes. That's fantastic. I was actually wondering about that because I know that, you know, the weight slips away and you wouldn't necessarily, you could sort of tell, but yeah, that's fantastic. So FaceTime winds up giving a few snapshots over time, and those snapshots show the stark relief from time to time to the observer. That's fabulous, Nathan. That's almost, you know what, it almost suggests that it's not a bad idea, wouldn't be the worst idea for people to take pictures of them daily
or every couple days. Oh, I encourage that here. Yeah, so they can look back and actually see. Yep.
Yes. Oh, that's good. Good thinking. Great work. Good biofeedback mechanism. Excellent.
All right. Dr. Lai, you have time? We have time for one more, the one on the mild depression?
One more. We'll do one more.
Okay, so our next question actually is now, it's in the same continuum, but now we're going a little bit in the other direction, which is about depression. Dear Dr. Lyle, if mild depression is an uncomfortable feeling that prompts us to evaluate our behavior in some cases, which would be a positive move to make if we need to make adjustments, how would a more serious form, including suicide, be evolutionarily beneficial? Is this a helpful response gone awry due to more than tolerable social conditions? And do you think we have more depression today than in previous decades, centuries, or civilizations?
No, I don't think there's any more depression today. The evidence would indicate that it's probably less. People are happier now than they were 50 years ago in the United States. People might say, really? Nobody I know. But the truth is that you have to look at huge, you know, sort of base rate data. You have to do big data analysis, and there's people in wealthier societies are happier than people in poor societies. I don't care how much they smiled at you when you were in Machu Picchu. The truth is they were smiling at you, hoping that you'd throw them a quarter. Okay, so the poorer people are surprisingly not as miserable as you'd think, but there's a reason why that's true, which is because they're actually competing with each other for sexual resources, and it doesn't take a lot of resources to do that. So as long as you can survive, the next problem in biology is reproduce. And if everybody's on a similarly meager playing field, then it's okay. Not too bad. Okay. Whereas, we know that if we were in their circumstances in our society, it would completely rule you out of all kinds of social processes. If you're a male, you're just completely out of it in the mating arena. You've got to have some kind of resources. And if you're a female, you can't even feed your children at that level, essentially. So, but when we transpose our thinking and observe people in other societies that have so much less, we are thinking that this is a horrible situation when in fact it is not. It's no more horrible than you going out with a group of people and camping with very little other than enough food to get by. And you're looking at the stars and you stay out of the rain and you tell stories around the campfire and then you try to get laid. Okay, well, that's what they're doing. So it's really not that much different. Now, however, it turns out that more material wealth makes people more secure, less anxious, happier, and gives them more options to actualize all the potentials that sit inside their nervous system for enjoying their life. So wealthier is better. People, and therefore we are also better off today than we were 50 years or 100 years ago in the United States. And the average net happiness of the average individual in the United States is higher than it's ever been. So that's how that works. And that's true around the world as incomes and security rises. So we are not less happy. But now the question is about as the person said, well, mildly discomfort is a signal of a problem with the person's relationship to environment. Well, so is an acute one. Okay, so at what point does this become a quote dysfunctional signal? And my answer would be, I don't think it does. So if you're a little bit depressed, it's signaling that you had a mild disappointment that you thought you were going to get X and it turned out you got Y instead, and Y is less than X and you're not very happy about it. And, you know, you just got a poor, you know, where you got an average report on your abilities in your job for your annual review and you were expecting above average and you're kind of unhappy about it. Okay. The next level would be your girlfriend just found somebody else and they're falling in love with them and they're so sorry, but she's going to leave you and you're planning on marrying her. Well, that's worse. Okay. So we're a hell of a lot less happy, i.e. much more depressed about that than we were about a moderately poor job review. Okay. So, all right, let's keep watching that. Now let's talk about, something else that could be worse. Got a diagnosis of cancer and it looks pretty dicey. They think they may be able to fix it, but they're not so sure that they can. And you're 43 and you got a couple of kids and now what? Uh-oh, pretty disturbing. A lot of anxiety and some dark thoughts, okay? So where does it magically become dysfunctional? Well, in the third case, the concern and even depression is driving you to analyze every cost-benefit carefully, the major issues in your life that you may need to reorganize in terms of priorities. And so the entire experience, as unpleasant as it is part and parcel of a major analysis of all your assets and your liabilities and your responsibilities as you think through what's in your best interest and then try to figure out what on earth you're going to do with a hand that is very depressing to look at. Now, now let's go one step further. Let's go to someone who's so depressed and distraught that they're contemplating suicide. Okay. Two things should come to mind. Well, first of all, let's try to think about, I'm sure I've talked about this earlier in probably podcast 64, God knows where it is. But suicide is an adaptive mechanism. This is a genetically built-in system. And one might say, how could this possibly be? And the reason is that you are designed by nature to survive and reproduce in order to increase the likelihood of what's called gene survival. That is your biological purpose and that is your programming. That means that you happen to be very concerned about your genes that are located inside of other bodies. So, for example, that's why you care about your children so much if you have children, because your children are the vehicles by which your genes are going to get into the next generation. And so it's also going to be true that your life is a member of a gene team. It's even though you are a unique individual point of consciousness that will never be repeated, that you are living your own life and much of that life is a solo internal experience. The truth is that mathematically and biologically, you're kind of a member of a team. And your objective is to optimize the team, even though you don't quite see it that way necessarily and you can't quite grasp it, that is in fact what's taking place. That's why you're more likely, all things being equal, to loan $5,000 to your brother than your best friend. Okay, now you might say, I'm not so sure. Depends on your brother. Yeah, it does. In other words, but all things being equal, I said, all things equal, likely to get paid back. All things being equal, that it was going to be used wisely. All things being equal, etc. All things being equal, that their brother's just as a stand-up guy as your best friend, but he's your brother, so he's going to stand up even faster for you than your best friend would. Why? Hamiltonian genetic dynamics. This is just straight. This is straight selfish gene. So so what suicide is the suicide is going to be suicidal ideation is going to be related to thinking through whether or not your gene team is better off without you. And so people will have a lot of suicidal thoughts when they are picking up cues and calculating from the environment that their gene team may be better off without them. And so, and it could be the case, folks. In other words, that might be true. And so we'll see that a lot of suicidality happens in much later life when people may feel like they're draining the family resources and they feel like they have nothing to contribute, i.e., just they're not getting any signals of love from people, and they're not getting any signals that people need them for anything. And they may be in pain, and they don't have any resources, and it's requiring money for their daughter, their adult daughter, to take care of them and to get help for them. And that takes money out of their grandchildren's mouth and educations and futures and everything else. So that you can see under those circumstances, which are heartbreaking to contemplate, that such a person might be thinking, that a circuit could say, hey, are we more trouble to our gene team than we are benefit? And it runs a cost-benefit analysis, just like it does with all other behavior. Okay? And if that cost-benefit analysis comes up and says, you know what? I think we're more cost than we are benefit, then you could expect that suicidal ideation could become profound. Then what we tend to see is something else. We will tend to see that those individuals will then run a lot of times trial balloons. So they may make an attempt or make a lot of noises. They may cut themselves so that other people can see it, even though they may hide it in the modern environment, but they couldn't have hidden it in the Stone Age. But they may do things that signal to their environment that they're in real trouble, and that they then see what the market response is. Now, if the market response is to throw a blanket of love around them in ways that convince them that they're extremely valuable, then we're likely to have that be a transient process. But what if they don't? Okay, so what if we essentially threatened suicide? What if we held a suicide party and nobody came? What if nobody cared? Okay, well, don't think that isn't going to impact the analytics. So when people are either isolated, there's no gene team for them to contribute to, they have no way of getting esteem signals from other people, or they feel like they're a drain on their gene pool, these are all things that swirl around and will increase the likelihood of suicide. I've been directly associated with two suicides in my career. In both of those cases, both pretty shocking, both of those cases, the individuals definitely believed that they were drains on their gene pool. It's very clear that that's what they were thinking. There's been other serious attempts that I've been aware of. In those cases, people generally are feeling like they just don't see how they can... that's a major theme that you will see. This was first brought to my attention in the work of David Buss, who I don't know if he did this directly or he was reporting on it. I can't remember. But he basically said, listen, suicidal ideation doesn't come from nowhere. There's clearly a reason for it. And I think that if we look down through it, we're going to see we're going to see an evolutionary logic to it. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not often a horrible mistake. That doesn't mean that somebody who gets to that point, has an attempt, fails at the attempt, survives, and, you know, essentially completely turns their life around and has a tremendously productive life. So it doesn't mean that if they committed suicide, quote, it was the right thing to do. But what I'm saying is that the only reason why that's in there is because, believe it or not, it might be the right thing to do for the best interest of their genes. And so that's why that would be in there. The reason why we're saying this is that we're basically saying, listen, this is a human universal. Okay, this is like sneezing is a human universal. This wasn't invented in, I don't know, you know, upstate New York or in Seattle. No, this is everywhere around the globe for as long as we have recorded history. So clearly, this is a natural human characteristic, and it's a natural human characteristic that takes place under certain conditions, and then those circuits get activated, and we may observe the behavior. As rare as it is, we may then see the behavior. Okay, so the notion of the questioner is, you know, does some line get crossed and something, you know, like suicide mean that it's just all haywire? No, it doesn't. It means the person's life is, you know, got some tragedy to it, that they are confused about their situation. They don't know how to move forward. They don't know how to chisel out more success or to be a greater contributor to their team. And so they're in trouble. And this may be, obviously, I don't think there's any doubt about this, that certain personalities are going to be much more susceptible to making this inference than others. Okay, so there's going to be a major genetic component is going to float its way through this, but that would be true with anything. Okay, so there'd be a major genetic component to, you know, who would be more likely to bungee jump than someone else. So just as you're more likely by genetics to have accidents, car accidents or any other kind of accidents, you're also more genetically likely in some cases to be suicidal. But that doesn't mean that whole thing is any sort of bizarre dysfunction of the modern environment or anything else. These are ancient circuits that are designed to go off under certain conditions and will more likely go off under certain individuals under those conditions than others. But it's all part and parcel of the same general process of depression, which is that we're getting a lot of negative feedback from our environment about our struggles to compete and to contribute.
Wow, Dr. Lau, thank you so much for taking a tough topic and shedding a lot of light on it.
Fantastic, Nathan. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.